Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. We are we're talking about losers today.
Oh, man, I'm a loser, baby. So why don't you kill me? Speaking of that era, remember that band, The Presidents of the United States of America?
Yeah, changed the world with only five strings between them.
Yeah, exactly. I was about to say, yeah, that was their whole gimmick. But I re-listened to a couple of their tunes. They had that song Lump, which I think is still kind of a banger. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, how could anyone forget Peaches? Mm-hmm. You know, being situated where we are, millions of peaches for me. You like peaches, Ben?
Yeah, I'm not averse to a peach. There's something, I think my childhood view of peaches was probably skewed because I had had to pick them in the past, and then also growing up, there were a lot of poems out there about how sensual peaches are.
Ah, yes, so felt, the erotic fruit.
Exactly. So that was a weird thing for young Ben to hear. And you're Noel, and that's our super producer, Max Williams. Who also, Max, this idea was your concept. You came to us with this. We think it's going to be a continuing series. We're not going to do them all consecutively because, as it turns out, maybe we're being a little unfair when we call these folks losers. The better term would be people who repeatedly and unsuccessfully ran for president. Which is, you know, there's no shame in that. Only 46 people have ever had the job, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you're in somewhat of a rarefied air, you know, with that particular job. And as we know, it doesn't necessarily like pay a gazillion dollars, but it does afford some pretty serious opportunities after the fact for book deals, and not to mention all of the associations and contacts that you make while in that job that you could then parlay into other interesting gigs as a civilian.
Oh, yeah. Good call on that one. You got the book deals, you got the speaking circuit, you've got all sorts of boards and foundations. Yeah, and you get a pension unless you really mess up. So if you have been president, even an unpopular president, then you are pretty well set up for the rest of your life in the public sector. But we know there are elections in democracies, which means there has to be a loser, there has to be a winner. And we all remember the names of the winners because, you know, history is sort of written by the winners when you think about it. But like Max pointed out, we don't know the names of a lot of the unsuccessful candidates, you know, like the Goldwaters, for instance, or the Samuel J. Tildens. You would know about that if you are an historian or if you're a big presidential history buff. And You know what this reminded me of at the top, and I know we're going to talk about it later, but when you guys were growing up and you were in history class in school, did you ever hear those stories where the teacher would say, well, Abraham Lincoln ran and then he lost, but he didn't give up. And that's America, you know?
That is America, baby. Never give up. But sometimes that perseverance ain't for nothing. It can pay off sometimes. We've got five presidents in particular where that stick-to-itiveness, that can-do spirit has in fact led to great success. We've got your Thomas Jeffersons and Andrew Jacksons and William Henry Harrisons and Grover Clevelands of the world, and also Richard Nixon, who was a loser for a different reason. All these fellas finished as second-place winners, runner-ups, also rans, but then they later won themselves the presidential election. But unfortunately, there were quite a few folks, maybe not quite a few, but a few folks who ran on a major party ticket a second time and lost. And two folks who even did it a third time and also lost that third time.
Mm-hmm. And before we get into our examples for part one of this series, I just got to note, that's kind of unusual for jobs in general. If you apply for a job and they say you're not the right fit, and then you come back next year and you say, how about now? And then you come back the third time and say, how about now?
I'm going to say it's even worse than that, Ben. So it would be like, you know, if I came here and I talked to you, Ben, and you're like, yeah, Max, I'll see you. You took me up to the iHeart's high ups and they're like, nah, he's good. And then a year later, I came to you and you said, yeah, let's do that again. And we go to the iHeart high ups and they're like, no, seriously, we're not doing this. And we did it a third time because it's like they got the nomination from their party a couple times. It's not like they just showed up and said, let's do this.
You know, what's funny about that, Max, is Noel and I have done that exact thing before with some of our team members.
I assumed as much, but yeah.
Because we can be a bit tenacious. And I think that's, you know, I think that's a good character quality for both of us. Maybe that makes us regular Charles C. Pinckneys, not to be confused with another guy named just Charles Pinckney.
We'll get it. The C is important.
Yeah,
the C is important. Very, very different people. We're talking here today about Charles Cotesworth Pinckney.
Love it. I love a
Cotesworth. Born of February of the 25th, 1746. He was a soldier, diplomat, statesman, destined for a life of public service. In 1769, he became a member of the South Carolina Assembly, served his country in the South Carolina First Provincial Congress of 1775, and he later was a member of both houses of the South Carolina legislature.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's involved in politics from early on. His involvement in American politics predates the United States. That's how old school he is. He later worked with George Washington in a couple of different capacities. He commanded a regiment in Savannah. He was there at the Constitutional Convention, along with his cousin, the other guy named Charles Pinckney. And here's what went down with our buddy Chuck. It's 1796. The Federalist Party, which was still a big thing, supports John Adams for president, but their vote got split. And because their vote got split, old Tommy J, Thomas Jefferson, became the vice president. And this is something that I think all students of U.S. history have found kind of weird. For a while there at the beginning, if you won the election, you became president, the guy who was running against you, or excuse me, the person who was running against you, automatically became vice president. So your worst nemesis is supposed to be your co-pilot of democracy. It made for some awkward state dinners, we can only imagine.
Oh, absolutely. It sure did. The 1800 election was, in fact, a rematch between Adams and Jefferson. In order to keep the same result from transpiring a second time, repeating the 1796 election, both parties essentially wanted to ensure that their electors were united. You know, those tricksy electors, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that the members of the college.
Yeah, exactly. So they said, let's move as a unit. Let's be a unified front. We don't want the enemy in our house again. So Adams, on the Federalist side, runs with the person Max's side referred to as our boy, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, while Jefferson's running mate was the infamous Aaron Burr of Hamilton fame. That whole election could be its own episode, but the long story short, as the internet says, the TLDR version, is that their system didn't work. It wasn't the best idea. Jefferson still became president instead of Aaron Burr. So Charles Pinckney is not in the game, but he doesn't give up. He takes this on the chin. He hits the floor of the boxing ring and he says, he gets up like Captain America. He's like, I could do this all day. And he runs for president again in 1804.
And this did not go particularly well. Jefferson was in a particularly good position, the catbird seat, as it were, to win that second term. He had maintained moderate policy agendas that helped him kind of become this sort of go-between the parties, the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, basically playing partisan politics. Jefferson secured all of the electors except just a couple, Connecticut, Delaware, and two of Maryland's votes. And Pinckney then would go on to try again in 1808. And this time, things looked a lot more sunshiny for the guy. Thomas Jefferson had kind of blessed James Madison, who was his Secretary of State, given him the old successorship kind of, seal of approval. Mm-hmm. But there was this thing that had caused sort of like a bit of an outcry, a bit of an uproar amongst the citizenry. The Embargo Act of 1807, which was a risky foreign policy maneuver that Jefferson and Madison had come up with. And it had some unfortunate, unintended consequences, some negative impacts on the United States economy, and it led to kind of fracturing within the Democratic Republican Party, some sort of splintering of groups.
Yeah, so the Embargo Act it's a pretty broad brush, to be honest. The idea was that Uncle Sam wanted to stop the United Kingdom, stop Britain from basically pressing American sailors into non-consensual service. And as like, that's the seed of the idea. What it ended up being is a general trade embargo on all foreign nations, which is very bad for a young nation, right? So this was terrible for business. It doesn't make Jefferson look great. And the Federalist Party, which again, still a thing, says, you guys aren't even going far enough with how bad the Embargo Act is. As a matter of fact, we think James Madison is working against this country. We find him seditious, traitorous, because how else could you explain such a stupid, unhelpful policy? And because of that, in this time of chaos, C.C. Pinks, Charles C. Pinckney, is elected as the presidential nominee because people hate him less just right now. He's
what does
the
that sound
less
like?
Terrible guy. Right.
Kind of, yeah. That sort of sounds like a bit of a mirror of current politics.
Oh,
maybe
right.
Not quite as extreme, but yeah, I don't think people were exactly super stoked about Biden, but he was definitely, better than the alternative for folks on the Democratic side. So, right, he was nominated. He didn't get the nomination, which is in and of itself a big deal because they're really having to put all of their support, put all of their eggs in his proverbial basket. And former U.S. Ambassador and New York Senator Rufus King was nominated for vice president. And that is the exact same ticket that the Federalists had presented back in 1804. So history repeating.
Yeah. Also, shout out to the old figure of speech that it's insanity to do the same thing and expect different results. So they just said, hey, remember that thing that didn't work last time around? What about now? Right? Now that things are worse. And the Federalists were doing pretty well in New England. But unfortunately, they didn't do well enough. Madison won the Electoral College again. He got 122 electoral votes to Pinckney's 47. And what this meant is that the Democrat / Republican Party is becoming a clear winner. It's just got the, it's the LeBron of political parties at this point, which is a little unfair because there are way more people playing basketball today than there are political parties in the U.S. But don't overthink the comparison. What we're saying is this was the nail in the coffin for Pinckney's attempts at running for president. And he says, you know what? I gave it a go. I gave it my due diligence, and I'm just going to go into law. I'm just going to be a lawyer. A lot of these guys were lawyers, basically. So it's not as if he was hurting for a job.
No, and that continues to be a pretty important prerequisite to this day, right? I mean, a lot of folks that successfully win the presidency do have backgrounds in law.
Oh, yeah. And there's also an interesting thing when you look at other countries. Like I believe it was the government of China, the majority of political figures tend to be engineers or people with an engineering background, whereas the majority of people, or a huge minority at least, a significant portion of politicians in the U.S. are, as you said, attorneys.
Now, do you think that's just a cultural difference, or is there something in that system of government that's conducive to, you know, having that background being sort of helpful versus ours?
Yeah, it's a good question, man. I've always wondered, and I don't have an answer for that, but we would, of course, love to hear your take on that, folks. And the statistic may have changed over time, but I remember reading that. That's one that stayed with me. So there we go. Our first guy who is ever the best man, never the groom of the wedding of American politics, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. He seems to, unfortunately, have a contagious air of defeat about him, because later Federalist nominees like DeWitt Clinton run and they lose to Madison again. And then in 1816, Rufus King, who you mentioned earlier, former vice presidential candidate to Pinckney, he runs and he gets waxed. Nobody is backing the Federalist Party enough to even really swing the needle. So that is Pinckney. And you could also make a case that part of the reason you don't hear about the Federalist Party running candidates now, or like as a political party, is because of this series of defeats throughout this era of history. There's still the Federalist Society, but that's a whole other bag of badgers.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
If we've learned anything in the process of doing this podcast, just living life, it's that there's always a catch.
So when we heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month if you get a 3-month plan, we looked at each other and we thought, nah, what's the catch?
But here's the thing. In this case, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online.
Yeah, they cut out that middleman cost of retail stores and they pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. We're not joking. We have tried out Mint Mobile ourselves, and it's super convenient. And it actually, like, we tried to find a catch, and there's not one.
So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan.
Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on the incredible true story, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare reveals the gripping tale of the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Get tickets now for this action comedy masterpiece that defies expectations, showcasing how one daring mission reshaped history and set the stage for modern black ops warfare using unconventional and utterly ungentlemanly techniques.
Starring Henry Cavill, known for his iconic portrayal of Superman, and Alan Ritchson, star of Reacher, get ready for a mission with a little madness and a lot of mayhem.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R, and in theaters April 19th, get tickets now. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
All right. Up next, we have a fella that kind of hits home. Hits a little close to home, at least conceptually. A guy named Henry Clay. Here's a quote from Senate.gov on Henry Clay. Henry Clay enjoyed a distinguished political career, even though he never attained his greatest desire, the presidency. Oh, poor Henry Clay didn't get his heart's desire. What he did get, though, is immortalized in indie rockdom with the Los Angeles-based band, the Henry Clay People, who, according to their Wikipedia, is the unofficial house band of our pals Josh and Chuck's podcast, Stuff You Should Know.
Nice. Yeah. And Henry Clay was a politician of note. He had his bona fides. He had his stripes. He was a man of the state, but he never attained the holy grail for every U.S. politician, which is the presidency. He's born on April 12, 1777 in Hanover County, Virginia. Like a lot of people at the time, he did not have the most extensive formal education, but he still taught himself law and was admitted to the bar in both Kentucky and Virginia in 1797, so at the young age of 20. And then he becomes a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives, where he serves three separate terms in the U.S. House, and he gets to be Speaker of the House pretty frequently. If you've been paying attention to U.S. news, you know that was recently a whole kerfuffle. Then he was in the U.S. Senate not once, but four different times. And over the course of his political career, he just keeps trying to run for president. And it just doesn't work out. Let's go to 1824, maybe.
Let's do that. But first, really quickly, I just want to pull the room here. What is that about? So this drive that we're sort of exploring, mm-hmm. You know, you already have a successful career in politics. You know, as we know, I mean, theoretically, you kind of make more of an impact as a member of the legislature. You know, you can actually affect laws and things like that and your constituents, and you're actually working for the people. The president is a bit more of a figurehead job. I mean, you definitely have a lot of power and you can veto things and all of that, but it just feels like, Where's the drive? Where does that come from? Is it about, like, you know, wanting to be the top dog? Is it entirely ego-driven? Or is there something that I'm missing as to maybe this Henry Clay fellow or you know, our buddy Pinckney just really thought that they could affect more change from the presidential palace?
I mean, I won't speak to all of them, but I will speak about, I think this for Henry Clay is there was just kind of this assumption with these guys that eventually they would be president.
They paid their dues. They deserved the seat. They were
so, like, instrumental in policy decisions and stuff. And the truth is, it's like, you know, as president, you can really lead what direction the policies are going. Like, obviously, you aren't in on the day-to-day of the making and passing of the policies, but you're like, we're going to do this thing. It's going to most likely get done, or at least your party's going to push for it. So you're really kind of spearheading.
You're setting the tone.
You also have, as president, you have particular powers in the realm of foreign relations and policy. So as in this time, in the 1800s, right, this would be an instrumental lever of power. And also, like you said, you know, people are sort of inculcated in the system. They're entrenched. They're the devil you know, which gives them a tremendous advantage over like a person of the people, even though so many politicians try to portray themselves that way. That's why you see, I don't want to sound too conspiratorial, but that's why you see people who are deep in Washington, D.C. culture come election time, all of a sudden pretending to own a farm. They're walking around, they're mending a fence. Now they have a truck. They got a cowboy hat. It makes no sense. They don't wear that normally.
That's I might true. Be a TV doctor, but now look at me hunting.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's that business of garnering favor has always existed in some way. And I would also point out that you have to be pretty ambitious to want and pursue a job that only one person can have at a time and less than 50 people have ever had. You know what I mean? There can be more than one astronaut at a time, but there's an ego there.
That's a little, I was about to say, it's a mixed bag. I mean, certainly I agree about, you know, being able to kind of steer the party's, you know, agenda, let's just say. But I think that rarefied air that we talked about at the top of the show certainly smells really sweet to some of these folks, including our buddy Henry Clay, who ran for president in 1824 at 47. And apparently, this one went down as one of the most nasty, hard-fought, chaotic, and corrupt elections in American history. Now, I don't know if that stacks up against the insurrection, you know, that we've seen of recent years. I would think that one probably will hold a place in that historical canon.
I mean, I don't know. This one actually got decided by the House of Representatives, which was kind of the goal of the insurrection, was to get to that point.
Okay, so this one took it a step further, maybe with a little bit less actual, you know, violence on our home turf. Ooh. So with the fall of the Federalist Party, the Democratic Republicans were now the only game in town. They were the one major American political party, which seems kind of counterintuitive to the whole idea of political parties, doesn't it? So four candidates were running for office. We have your John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, somebody named William Crawford. He seems to have faded a bit from political memory.
Well, he basically nearly died during this election. So, yeah.
Okay. Poor guy. We'll get back to him. And our buddy Henry Clay. And they were all running under the, you know, I guess, heading of Democratic Republicans. Isn't that funny now, the idea of Democratic Republicans? It seems like a oxymoron, right? Like jumbo shrimp, you know?
Right, there we go. I think you're right. There's a huge danger to only one political party running the show, or honestly, only two political parties running the show. But these four different candidates, they all represent these different regions, these different parts of U.S. identity, and these very different ideologies. So when the electoral votes all get counted up, which is, again, not the popular vote, Jackson gets 99 votes. Adams gets 84. Crawford gets 41. Clay gets 37. And what this means is that nobody got a majority. There's no clear winner.
Imagine that.
Yeah, what's obvious is that these people from the regions of their chosen candidate are just supporting their boy.
Right.
And that doesn't make for a very clean-cut election.
100%. I mean, at least when you have two, you know, political parties that are kind of splitting people's, you know, attention and opinions down very specific ideological lines, usually gives you something, well, pretty close to 50-50 sometimes in terms of the country's perspective, usually ekes out a little bit on one side.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes that margin is laughably close, right? And then sometimes it seems pretty historic and secure. Neither of those cases happened here. The House of Representatives then had to choose among the top three people. They went back to their paperwork and they looked at the 12th Amendment and they said, okay, it's up to us, great reps that we are, to, you know, pick one of these three. So Jackson, Adams, or Crawford. So Clay is cut out. Old Henry Dice Clay, kidding. Wouldn't that be fun?
It would Dice be Man for president.
Yeah.
The Dice Man cometh.
Ooh, I don't know, man. His comedy did not age well.
A fun artifact, though, to experience. Yes. Because you can find some of his stand-ups on YouTube.
Yeah.
The best part about it is watching the audience. They are the yuppiest yuppies, the whitest yuppiest yuppies I've ever seen in my entire life. And they just think his Mary had a little lamb and she was a, you know, like, you can bleep that part out. That's literally his whole bit, you know?
I think he's just saying dirty, transgressive words. But when I was a kid, I'll be honest, I love that stuff. I didn't know most of what it meant, but I knew I would get in trouble if I said it. And I was like, look at this guy. You know, he's hot. Oh, but Henry Clay, in what we can only imagine was a tremendous, gets eliminated. He can't be president, but he's still Speaker of the House. So you have lost the game, and now you're the guy who decides who wins the game, which, you know, could be a recipe for bitterness to a lesser statesman. Ultimately, February 9th, 1825, Adams is elected president. He wins 13 states. This gives him the majority. And right after Adams gets inaugurated, Clay becomes Secretary of State, which to me sounds like a little bit of quid pro quo, Clarice.
One hand labs.
Washing the other. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Now that film does hold up.
It absolutely holds
it's
up.
It's nuts how good that is.
It's very good. But you know why it holds up, Ben? Because it's just good and it doesn't feel like it's repping an era per se, or like it doesn't have any hallmarks of 80s or 90s-ness. It was one of those like 80s, 90s cusp movies, but like anything that is remotely dated works for the movie. Like that song Goodbye Horses, obviously, very 80s sounding song, but the way it's used is just iconic, and it just, you'll never hear that song and not think of Buffalo Bill dancing tucked in the mirror.
Yeah. And also that kind of, when you do really well in a role like that actor, it can be bad for your career to be a very talented portrayer of a serial killer.
He did go on to have a pretty good long-running career, I believe, in one of the Law & Order series.
Yes, yeah, I think you're right. One of the true crime things, mm-hmm. but you didn't see him in a ton and ton of blockbuster feature films. Anyway.
Weirdly, though, they also didn't cast him as another serial killer creep, to my recollection.
No, I think it's a one and done. Just like the guys in Mindhunters mm-hmm. were saying, hey, this will be my one time as Ed Kemper or whatever.
Although, not to contradict you too directly, Ben, but the guy that played Charles Manson in Mindhunter also played Charles Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well, that guy's an exception because he looks exactly like Charles
100%.
Manson.
100%. That's why.
He has to do that. If he had a job selling cars, his manager would say, hey, man, you're either doing great because everybody wants to buy a car from Manson, or you're doing terrible because everybody is scared how much you resemble Charles Manson. Anyway, last point on this, and this is a controversial point before we move on with Clay. I was listening to unrelated research for a different show. I was listening to a lot of actual interviews with serial murderers, and not in a glorified way. It hit me, and I hate to say it, but I think most serial murderers would probably want a podcast. And I think Ed Kemper probably could have hosted a podcast.
Oh, yeah. Charles Manson definitely could have. I bet his podcast would have been called Stacking the Nickels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Charles. Maybe you've seen that amazing clip.
Roll the Nickels.
Roll the Nickels.
The game is mine.
The game is mine. Back to Henry Clay, which, by the way, does strike me as a bit of a serial killer.
I was going to say, there's no proof that he's not a serial killer. that little bit of logic parkour?
That's anyway. How we do. That's all it takes, you know? No proof to the contrary. But at this point, you know, I certainly likely would have said, you know what? F*** it. I'm done. I'm moving on. I'm going to do something else. or it would have broken my psyche. And then I may have become Henry Clay, the serial killer. But Henry Clay was not your average guy. And he decided that he absolutely wanted to continue this pursuit.
Yeah. So he still wants to become president. Again, tenacious, ambitious, and not one to give up easily. He gets his next chance in 1832, and he's directly running against Andrew Jackson. Jackson is still a pretty popular guy in politics as he's ending his first term as president. But
he's kind of a trash person, though, right?
No, isn't he's not one a good person.
Yeah, he's one of those dudes that really, upon further inspection, was like one of the worst.
Yeah, but the kind of the problem with it, especially this era of politics, is you're like, wow, that person's a trash person. Who are they running against? And you look at who they're running against. Like, yeah, wow, that person is somehow even more of a trash person.
It was kind of a trash contest. But mm-hmm. The thing is, in this realm, even if you're a fan of Jackson at the time, you have to admit that he has such personal enmity against his vice president, John C. Calhoun, that it is impacting the business of politics. It's messing up both of their jobs in the Capitol. So he starts saying this other stuff that strikes people sideways. He says, we need to get rid of the Electoral College. We need to get rid of rotation of office and federal government. That I want to make some big changes, all of which seem to empower me, by the way. And so people don't like that because they're saying, hey, our whole thing is we don't want kings, even though low-key we tried to make George Washington king back in the very beginning. So he is maybe feeling a little too authoritarian for some people. And all this to say, it leads the National Republicans to nominate Clay for president, and they run against him, and Clay takes an L. He absolutely loses because Jackson was unpopular, but still more popular than Clay, you could say.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on the incredible true story, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare reveals the gripping tale of the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Get tickets now for this action comedy masterpiece that defies expectations, showcasing how one daring mission reshaped history and set the stage for modern black ops warfare using unconventional and utterly ungentlemanly techniques.
Starring Henry Cavill, known for his iconic portrayal of Superman, and Alan Ritchson, star of Reacher. Get ready for a mission with a little madness and a lot of mayhem.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R, and in theaters April 19th, get tickets now.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Again, most people would have given up the ghost, thrown in the proverbial towel at this point, but not Henry Clay. He says, I see a lot of potential here. I'm going to take all these people who don't vibe with Jackson and I'm going to make a party based on not liking Jackson. And if you try to build something based entirely on objections to something else without a positive direction or path, then you're kind of setting yourself up to fail. I posit to you, gentlemen, that is the story of the Whig Party.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, it certainly is a good tactic to maybe divide people, but it's not a very good tactic for, you know, getting the job done. Because when you divide people, then no one can agree on anything. And everything's just kind of based on that divisiveness instead of, like, you know, unity and like betterment of our country and the lives of everyday people. So, yeah, the Whigs really had nothing in common outside of their hatred of Jackson. They had no central kind of governing ideology, and they were often divided on these very, you know, kind of broad lines. So the election of 1836 really threw a huge spotlight on these issues when the party entered its first presidential contest. And they ran no less than three candidates from wildly different parts of the country. Clay, however, was not one of them.
Yeah. This is where Martin Van Buren wins. Because, again, there's a lot of king-making here. There's a lot of guys being kind of mafioso about this and saying, this is my chosen, you know, successor. This is my boy. He will run the operation when my time is past. And that was... that was a 10-10 impression of President Jackson talking about Martin Van Buren. No one fact check it. So Van Buren wins the presidency. What a day. What a great week that guy is having until the economy just goes into a tailspin. That's the problem with being president. You're also held responsible for a ton of stuff that you could never actually control. So you become the country's number one scapegoat. And there's this depression that ensues. This chaos looks like an opportunity for the Whig Party. And they're saying when this 1840 election comes up, since everybody's so mad at Van Buren, it's our time to shine, baby. And Clay thinks, finally, all my work will have led to something. And he's wrong, because his party nominated another guy, a general named William Henry Harrison. He's a war hero. You know him from Tippecanoe. And they said they did this because they were kind of like a marketing department. When you think about it, they were looking at stuff they thought people would like. And they said, you know, America elected Jackson because he's a military man. So let's find a military guy, not necessarily a politician. And that's when Clay said, okay, I'm going to keep a stiff upper lip. I'm going to keep my chin up. I'm going to go with the party. And I am also going to promote William Henry Harrison, even though I've always wanted to be president, and I think I would be pretty good about it. And then someone says, Clay, what are you mumbling over there? And he goes, nothing, go Whigs.
Go Whigs. Yeah. There was a really fun band out of Athens, Georgia called the Whigs for a while. And I always enjoyed them, and I thought that was a clever name for a band because it kind of sounds more like a band than a party. But William Henry Harrison, as you mentioned, he didn't last long. Poor fellow. He must have been a frail as a daffodil, as Max likes to affectionately call Ben and I sometimes. He made a bit of a long-winded speech in the rain and didn't go well for him after that. And Max, to your point off mic, this isn't necessarily proof positive of what killed him, but it's definitely something that's talked about a lot in like presidential lore.
Oh yeah. It was let's see. I think the speech itself, according to the transcript, was 8,445 words. This is very long, and people have to stand there the whole time. You can't dip out, right? For comparison, I think the shortest inaugural address ever was George Washington's second address. It was 135 words. It's basically like he came in and said, good game, everybody, you know?
Well done. We did it. Deuces.
U.S. rules, Britain drools. All right, let's get some nog.
Let's nog it up, baby. Yeah. Let's get stinko. You guys ever heard that expression? It's an old one. Like getting stinko, that's getting really drunk, I guess.
Oh, I've maybe. Heard blotto as well.
Yeah, blotto's good. Stinko's a good one. You hear it. If you watch any like noir movies, you'll learn, you'll have a great new 50s vocabulary for getting really wasted.
Oh, also, Harrison was, the weather was like 48 degrees Fahrenheit. Harrison wasn't wearing the kind of clothing you would wear. He didn't have an overcoat or hat or gloves. And then he...
Look,
yeah,
I'm not saying he deserved to die, but you made me hang out in the rain like that, listening to you babble on and on. You're not my favorite person, I'll tell you that.
Right. You know, it's... This is why we should have a TV show where we do reproductions of stuff, or at least guest on Drunk History. Anyhow, so yeah, it like Max said, it's not conclusively proven that his speech right before he caught a cold led to his death, but it feels weird. Anyway, he got sick like 3 weeks after he made that speech. So it might have just been his habit of walking out and maybe he was doing a bunch of off-the-book speeches at just random people in bad weather.
Maybe just night walks where he just was talking to himself. All right.
Thin ice, my friend. Thin ice.
Hey, whoa. No. I'm just saying. Night walks, you know, can be a dangerous thing if you're not dressed appropriately.
No, that's conditions. A very good point. And I think we both love a good night walk. Oh, man. And we can never tell this story of that one night walk in New York recently.
We can tell. We can hint.
We can hint.
Like, show me the money.
There we go. There it is. That's
or don't.
That's
perfect. It's entirely up to you.
That's perfect. Yeah. Poetry, Noel. So, all right. So immediately after Harrison dies, you know, you've got the secession, right? The changing of the guard and the peaceful passage of power, transfer of power. So John. No, keep it. I always like that one. Mm-hmm. And this makes John Tyler the president. John Tyler was never really intended to be the president by the Whig Party. He was put up there as a demographic play. People liked the part of the country he was from. You know, there's a lot of that kind of horse trading in politics in general.
Absolutely.
Right. So it became obvious that he was like a wino, a Whig in name only, because he was only a Whig because he's beefed up with President Jackson. He didn't agree with any other thing that the Whigs stood for, like none of it. And so eventually they kicked him out of the party. That's how unpopular a president he was. Eventually, the Whig Party itself was kind of on the downslope, and Henry Clay resigned from the Senate and said, you know why he resigned, right? Can you guess? As if we don't have the same notes.
I can't guess, Ben, but I do know, and I think it was probably a reasonable bet that he wanted to spend his time elsewhere, preparing to once again run for president in 1844.
Oh, my God. I mean, come on. Like, I respect the determination, the doggedness, and the ambition again. But at some point, don't you have to ask yourself, hey, am I being like someone who gambles too much? Am I just continually telling myself that this pull of the slots will be the one that makes me a millionaire? Right?
I mean, tell yourself whatever you want. If you've got the stamina and the perhaps lack of self-awareness to keep pushing and pushing and pushing like this, I guess more power to you. But history is going to remember you this way. You're going to be in one of these podcasts. So, yeah.
Wow.
That's just going to happen for you.
Well, that, you know, we're a nice show. We're nice to people.
I suppose we are.
We're fair. We're fair. How about that?
That's true. That's true. Harsh, but fair.
So this is, given the age that Clay is at this time, in 1844, he's 67 years old. So if we're being realistic about it, this is probably going to be one of the last, if not his last, chance to become president. And he finally has earned enough goodwill for the Whig Party to support him. But he comes out looking bad in a couple of great debates of the time. The issue of annexing Texas, what that means for the horrific institution of slavery. This is the most divisive political issue of the day for the you know, for the politician class. And the Democratic nominee, a guy named James K. Polk from Tennessee, says, "Hey, manifest destiny. Ooh. Come on, let's get big, U.S. baby." And people dig that. They're like, "Yeah, hey, you know what? James is right. We are great. We're just, you know, we are better than people is the thing. And we're going to vote for the guy who understands that."
Also, it is funny, like, you know, how the notion of manifest destiny is a conquering notion, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At best. And it's very funny how quickly, as a nation, we start to resemble our conquering former, you know, overlords.
Mm. Yeah.
In old Britain.
Yeah, exactly. History moves in cycles, right? And history is not exactly a study in innovation as much as we would like it to be. Manifest destiny came about in 1845. That's when the phrase was coined. And it is very much a religious ideology. One, there is a God. And two, that God is crazy pro-United States. Forget all the other problems of the world, physics, chemistry, and the universe. There is a God, and the God and God's main thing, whether or not you've read the book, is that this one country, the U.S., should expand as much as possible.
I got to say, Ben, I was hoping you were just going to stop it. There is a God, and that God is crazy.
that God is nuts. All the speeches are very Werner Herzog from politicians at that time. So at this point, Clay has lost. He's nearing his 70s. This is not a period in history where a 70-year-old president would be a common thing.
Right? People didn't live as long back then either, you know?
Yes, I mean, that's the case. It's cold to admit it, but it's true. So what does Clay do?
Well, one would think he'd do the old Homer Simpson backing into the bushes gif. He thought about that, but he did end up returning to the Senate to assist in what was known as the Compromise of 1850. He was able to help kind of pull this thing out of the toilet. Was having some issues, and he was, you know, as a senior, literally, you know, as senator, was able to kind of help salvage the deal. But this would be the last thing that he did in government or in life. Perhaps he passed away shortly thereafter from tuberculosis in June of 1852. And I think he was the first American to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda before even Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. Abraham Lincoln, 12 years later, becomes the second American to lay in state in the Rotunda. And as a result of this, you know, we're giving him a hard time a little bit, but Henry Clay had a long and storied career. That's why a lot of historians will tell you, even today, he is the most powerful and important American to have never become president.
And look, we peppered this story, obviously, with some accomplishments that he did achieve. And he clearly was a competent statesman, but he just didn't have the range. He shouldn't have the range.
And a lot of it is timing and luck, you know, an opportunity. So you could be an amazing politician, a sincere one, and different circumstances beyond your control could just make it such that a political party doesn't see you as a viable candidate. That happens a lot, by the way, in U.S. history and in the history of democracies across the planet. We got to two people today. We went pretty in-depth on Pinckney and Clay, but there's much more to the story. As we said, we're going to make this a series that pops up every now and then when you least expect it. Maybe when we least expect it. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoyed this look at an often ignored, but very important part of U.S. history.
And hey, if you want to suggest to us another anthology style, collection of genres of stories, you can hit us up on the internet. Specifically, you can hit us up individually if you wish. I am on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown. Mr. Bolin, where can people find you?
Oh, what a time to be alive, folks, and in users of Instagram. You can find me calling myself at Ben Bolin in a burst of creativity, B-O-W-L-I-N, on Instagram. You can also head over to Twitter if you're more inclined to tweet and so on. You can find me at Ben Bolin, HSW. And while you are on Twitter, pro tip, don't follow me and then immediately say, well, I'm done. I've been super productive today. No, stay on Twitter and check out our pal, super producer, Max Williams.
Yes, you can find me at ATL underscore Max Williams. That's where I'll be.
Thanks, as always, to you, super producer Max, and research associate for this episode. Thanks, of course, to Jonathan Strickland, who, what'd you call him in the previous episode?
I think I called him a human leaf blower.
Our leaf blower.
Yes, indeed.
He's our Henry Clay, right?
Yes,
he doesn't give up, although we haven't heard from him in a while, but I think that might change.
Oh boy,
in the near term. You know what, I got a summoning bell.
Oh no,
that's just me testing the bell. Okay, that was just a practice ring.
Also, Beetlejuice rules, so we're not going to say his full name anymore right now. So in lieu of summonings, thanks also to Christopher Hasiotis, Eves Jeffcoat. Man, I'm such a fan of all our colleagues. Noel, sometimes I just want to thank people who aren't even associated with the show.
Or just make up names.
You know, thanks to Max Powers, astronaut with a secret, big supporter.
Yeah, thanks to Cuba Gooding Jr. He likes the show.
Thanks to Cuba, yeah. And Noel, most importantly, man, thanks to our listeners and thanks to you.
Yeah, you as well. We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com.